Well, thank you for being here. We are in Mark chapter 8, a serious set of verses tonight. We looked at it last week with the disciples basically not understanding who Jesus is. And what we're gonna break it down again tonight, because this is, I think, revealing for ourselves, revealing for myself especially. The book of Mark is going to hinge on this verse right here. What's taking place right here in chapter 8 is during this first half of the book of Mark, Jesus is doing great works, or mighty works, we'll say. He's revealing himself. There's struggling with understanding of who he is. They're going to come to this point right here tonight where Peter is going to identify him as the Messiah. Now, the problem with this is their understanding of Messiah, and we've talked about this from the beginning, we'll try and make it a little more clear tonight. Their understanding of Messiah is a very cultural, political idea that has developed, but yet the Bible talks about the Messiah and his ministry from the Garden of Eden, coming all the way through. But they've reduced it or only captured a small part of it. So when Peter identifies him as the Messiah, he's talking about this category. Jesus now is going to, it's going to say, he began to teach them plainly that the Messiah is going to have to suffer. From this point on, the rest of the story of Mark is that the Messiah that you've now identified is not going to do what you think he's going to do. They were thinking of a victorious, militant, and there's no, you can't blame them. It's they're limited in their understanding. Because of their culture, possibly because of what they've been allowed to understand. The verses that come before this story that we're going to look at tonight is the blind man. And the blind man is that was healed in a two-step process is going to go from being blind to seeing, we'll just say confused. He sees men like trees walking to then seeing clearly. And that's, again, you can look at that story and try and figure out what's going on in that story. I think as we look at Mark and what's taking place in this book, this blind man is an image of what's taking place with the disciples. They were, in a sense, blind on this whole time. Even when Jesus walked on the water, they asked the question, who is this? Who can do this kind of? Who can command the storm? Who can walk on water? They're like, who is this? They're in a sense blind. This whole first part. Now, again, that's you got. Then I think when I say that, anything back. Well, he sent them off on ministry. They proclaimed the kingdom. They healed. They cast out demons. But they're not really understanding who he is. They're blind to who he is. Tonight, Peter is going to say, "You are the Messiah." He's going to identify him, the Christ. We'll talk about that word, Christos in the Greek, which is the Greek translation of the Hebrew word for Messiah, which simply means anointed or to anoint. And when you get to the Old Testament and you find the word anoint or the anointed one, it can be the priest who was an anointed one. It could be the king who was, every king was anointed. It can be Cyrus, who was God's chosen, God's anointed for a purpose. Israel, in a sense, is God's anointed people. And so we do not come out of the Old Testament with what I would say, or what we've got as Christians or as Protestants, this very clean idea of what the Messiah is going to do. You know, the cross before the crown, all this, it all makes sense. They didn't even understand the idea of Messiah. Messiah meant the anointed. It could be the priest. It could be the king. It could be Cyrus. But when it came, began to be, and I'll talk about this tonight, it began to take on a special meaning of the Messiah, 200 B.C., 100 B.C., coming up out of the Old Testament. It became the ideal of the Messiah. And it attached itself, the Messiah, the eschatological Messiah, attached itself to the verses about reestablishing Israel. Like we've gone through the minor prophets on Tuesday nights. And there's always the idea of, but Israel will be restored, but I will restore the throne of David. I will restore, that's the Messiah. And the Messiah, very clearly, you see it in the Old Testament, is going to take Jerusalem. He's going to purify the temple. He's going to drive out the Gentiles. He's going to establish a unified rule over the earth, the Messiah. So when Peter finally says, as we see tonight, you are the Messiah, that's what he means. That's all that he means. He doesn't mean when we say Jesus is the Messiah, we've got all these things the Messiah does, sins of the world, and sits on this right hand of God and comes back in glory, coming back and defeating the Antichrist. We've got all, it's like they had him overthrowing the Romans, purifying the temple, driving out the Gentiles, destroying the sinners, and establishing Israel. So when Peter says, you are the Messiah, this right here, tonight, it's a true statement. But this guy right here, the blind man, he also could see. I see men like trees. And Jesus says, come here. And then he touched him again, and he saw clearly. When Peter says Messiah tonight, again, you don't have to accept what I'm saying, because when Jesus then began to teach them plainly, Peter is going to make it very clear, he rebukes Jesus. It's like, I see men like trees walking. And Jesus, well, here, let me fix that. And the man says, no, I see men like trees. Don't mess with this. This is perfect. It's like, well, no, you don't see clearly. That's not what you're supposed to see. And Peter right here, seeing the Messiah like a man like trees walking, Jesus began to teach very clearly, the Messiah has to suffer. And these guys have no place to put that information. This is astonishing. When you look at this, we can talk about it, but when we talk about Jesus Christ, the first place we go is the cross, well, probably the manger, and then the cross, and then Easter, and then someday he's coming back in the future. I mean, we go to the cross before we go to the eschatological return of Jesus, because that's a whole other area. It's like, well, we're not sure if he's coming back or if we're going there, if it's going to be a literal return. That's kind of confusing. For these people, they say Messiah, it's like he is definitely going to march on Jerusalem and take over. When they start talking about suffering, this is new information. And so that's what's taking place here. When they begin to understand this, now they're going to see clearly. But the same person that took the blind man and opened his eyes so he could see the men like trees walking is going to touch him again, and he's going to see clearly. Jesus is going to have spent this whole time leading up to this point where Peter's going to say, you are the Messiah. That's because Jesus has been, because on the boat going to Bethsaida, he rebuked them. Are your hearts still hard? Do you have ears that can't hear and eyes that do not see? What's it going to take? Well, by the time they get there, he's able to say, you are the Messiah. He's seeing, but he's totally confused. And Jesus is going to have to then spend more time teaching what he's going to do. And so that's what's going to take place tonight, and I'm going to try to show that to you. Let's go ahead and just read the text, first of all, in the NIV. Just to set the stage, I'm probably going to start in chapter 8, verse 14. They just left the west side of the Sea of Galilee, heading back to the northeast side to Bethsaida. The disciples had forgotten to bring bread, chapter 8, verse 14, except for one loaf that they had with them, and probably a small bun-like. Be careful, Jesus warned them. Watch out for the yeast of the Pharisees and of Herod. They discussed this with one another and said, it is because we have no bread. So again, they're missing the whole concept. Aware of their discussion, Jesus asked them, why are you talking about having no bread? And here's the series of questions. Do you still not see or understand? Are your hearts hardened? Do you have eyes but fail to see and ears but fail to hear? And then he goes back. Now he goes into teaching mode. That's their condition. You don't hear. You don't see. Now, do you remember or don't you remember when I broke the five loaves for the 5,000? How many baskets of pieces did you pick up? 12. And when I broke the 7 loaves, now this is Jesus reteaching. They know these things. They know the answer. He's going back. He says, think about it. Remember this event, and then what happened? And here's the second one. And when I broke the 7 loaves for the 4,000, how many basketfuls of pieces did you pick up? 7. And then he looks at him and says, do you still not understand? So he went back and tries to explain to them. And now they've got to figure out, why did we have so much left over? The answer is, this is the Messiah. This is the Christ. He is beyond anything as far as the politics, anything in the age that they're living in. He's God. Okay, now they land at Bethsaida. They came to Bethsaida, and some people brought a blind man and begged Jesus to touch him. He took the blind man by the hand and led him outside the village. Meaning this is not going to be a public healing. He's going outside. The people that are with him are the disciples. And he's going to show them. He took the man, blind man by the hand and led him outside the city or the village. When he had spit on the man's eyes and put his hands on him, Jesus asked, do you see anything? And now that he's going to ask Peter, who do you say that I am? And Peter's going to answer, do you see anything? He looked up and says, I see people. They look like trees walking around. Peter, who do you think I am? You are the Christ. His understanding, you know, I see something. It's out of focus, but I see something. Okay. It says, once more, Jesus put his hands on the man's eyes, or he's going to have to once more begin to teach the disciples. Then his eyes were open. His sight was restored, and he saw everything clearly. Now, that's the destiny of the disciples. The disciples are heading there, but they do not see clearly. They're still that place of, I see men like trees. You are the Messiah. You're going to march on Jerusalem. Okay, let me teach you again, and Jesus is going to touch him again, and eventually they'll be able to say, I see clearly. Now, it's interesting. This is Mark writing Peter's account. And you've got to wonder, because Mark traveled with Paul and Barnabas up into Asia Minor in the book of Acts early on, and for some reason he retreated. He went back. Paul wasn't happy about him abandoning them. In fact, the book of Acts says that Paul talks about them being abandoned by John Mark. John Mark was a young man in Jerusalem when this crucifixion takes place. We possibly see him at the Garden of Gethsemane in the brushes and then running away. The Last Supper would have been held at his house, so he would have seen these things and heard things just like the disciples heard that would include the coming of the kingdom. And he, like all of them, had an ideal of what that meant. Jesus is resurrected. And then the Holy Spirit comes, the church begins, it meets in John Mark's mom's house. In fact, Peter, when he's released from prison, by the angel, comes to John Mark's mother's house. And so there's this sense of victory, but there's this persecution. He goes with Barnabas, his cousin, and Paul on the first missionary trip. And what he may be expecting is maybe a little more victorious, a little more pronouncing the kingdom, a little more reception. You know, when they make a presentation, people are going to flock to them. A little more glorious, possibly. But, and again, I'm just saying that because he goes with Barnabas and Paul, and then as they get into it, the lower part of Galilee, Asia Minor, he turns and heads back to mom's house in Jerusalem. So there's a potential that there was a little disillusionment there even in Mark himself. So when he's writing this, he's writing about the disciples and what they went through. Well, he's going through the same process. He's eventually going to come to a greater understanding. Obviously, he's writing this book, and Paul is going to eventually say, Mark is useful for me, and is going to ask him to come help him write letters or bring Mark along. So that's just interesting as this goes through this right here, that Mark himself may have experienced some of that disillusionment and confusion. I thought I was following this Jesus, but Jesus is taking me a completely different way. And again, we as Christians, we know this is true in our own lives, where we have a, a plan. We and I know we can talk about it. I think I'm following God this way, and doors just get closed, and options are erased, and I end up going somewhere into the darkness where I know God has abandoned me, and I'm just trying to survive. And all of a sudden, I find I'm in the middle of God's plan. It's like, well, that's what's happening here with these guys. Mark chapter 8, verse 27. After he healed a man and sent him back into the city, here's our verses tonight. Jesus and his disciples went on to the villages around Caesarea Philippi. I'm going to look at a few things here. Around Caesarea Philippi. On the way, he asked them, now there's a two-phase question. Who do people say I am? What's out there? What have people understood so far about who I am? Now, that's an interesting question. We're going to come back and look at this in more detail. But who do people say that I am? If I were to ask you, you know, what do people think about Generation Word Ministries? What do they think about, you know, my Bible teaching? What do they say? I would not ask you, who do people say I am? It'd be more like, what do people think of what I say? What do people think of what I do? What are people saying about me? I would ask you, who do people say that I am? It's like, you know, so he's asking a question that's a little different than what we would even ask. Who do people say I am? Meaning he's not just got a ministry. He's just not teaching. He's not just doing miracles. He's asking for an identification of his person. You know, because it's like, what do people think of the miracles? Well, some of them are pretty impressed. Some of them are confused. Some of them think it's demonic. It's like, okay, now I'm not interested in that. Who do they think I am? It doesn't matter what you think of the ministry or the miracles or of his teaching. It's who do people say I am? And that's Jesus saying that. Who do people say I am? They replied, some say John the Baptist, others Elijah, and still others one of the prophets. They've got to classify him somewhere. And this was a typical popular idea. We saw Herod had said similar. Herod Philip had said, or Herod Antipas had said similar things. Then he says, but what about you? He asked, who do you say I am? Peter answered, you are the Christ. And Jesus warned them not to tell anyone about him. So he's probably addressing the whole group. Peter speaks up to, you know, speak for the whole group. It may be an individual revelation by Peter. It may be Peter speaking of the conclusion the group has come to that have been traveling with him. And Jesus warned them not to tell anyone about him. Once again, it's very clear. You are the Christ. That's the word Christos, which is a Greek translation of the Hebrew word for Messiah, to anoint. And they were looking for the Messiah, but the Messiah, which is also called the Christ or Christos here, is going to be the militant leader. So when Peter says, you are the Christ, he once again has to go back and say, warn them not to tell anyone about him. Don't say this to anyone. I am the Messiah. But don't tell anyone why. It's very clear, I think, why we don't want to tell anybody, because they will not understand. They think Messiah means I'm going to march on Jerusalem and overthrow the Romans. That's not what's going to happen. And here, and right here, do not tell anyone about this or about him. Don't tell them that I'm the Messiah, because they will not understand. But I'm going to explain it. He's going to explain to them. He says, verse 31, he then began to teach them about the Son of Man. See, now that's, again, another phrase. And these phrases are not connected in the Old Testament. Well, they are in our Old Testament, in our understanding. But the Jews at this time do not connect the Son of Man, the Son of David, the Messiah. They don't have the nice, tight connection that we get. We get several names, and it all comes together in Jesus. They had different categories for these people. And so when Jesus calls himself the Son of Man, we can throw up three titles here. Suffering servant, son of man, and we'll just say the Messiah. These are three different people in the Jews' mind. Now, again, we can put them all together. In their mind, we already talked about, first of all, Messiah could be anyone that's anointed. It could be a priest. It could be any of the kings. It could be Cyrus himself. Cyrus, God says, Isaiah, is my anointed one. He is my Messiah. But obviously, Cyrus was not the Messiah. So by the time the New Testament, let's say 200 to 100 B.C., and I'd like to say 0 B.C. or 1 B.C., but that looks weird, the idea of the Messiah had developed, that there was going to be the Messiah, and this Messiah was going to be the son of David. He was going to be the one that set up the kingdom. But you also go back, and Daniel talks about the Son of Man. Now, the Son of Man is an eschatological figure. I'll just write end times. He's an eschatological figure that's going to appear in the end, and not necessarily the Messiah. He's the Son of Man that's going to come and is going to come in the clouds of glory. He's going to come and be the judge of all mankind. Now, the Messiah is going to take over the kingdom of Israel. He's going to throw off the Gentiles. The Son of Man is an end time figure that's going to come back and will actually judge all mankind. Judgment's been given to the hand of the Son of Man. Now, that's the same people, same person. The Jews didn't understand that. So Jesus calls himself the Son of Man. Peter just identified him as the Messiah, but Jesus is about to go this direction, the suffering servant. Isaiah talks about this. We got that in the Garden of Eden. The seed of the woman, Son of Man, is going to crush the serpent's head. He's going to crush the power of Satan, but his heel will be bruised. He's going to do it. He's going to win the battle. He's going to establish the kingdom and crush all the power, but he will be bruised in the process. So you can see all this. The seed of the woman will take over, have the victory, but he will be bruised. I mean, so it's not like a new, it has been like being tied together and sewn together and made up by mankind. It's from the very beginning. It's just there was not a full understanding of this. So those are three titles: Messiah, Son of Man, Suffering Servant. Jesus has been calling himself this, and he's been acting like that as far as going around forgiving sin, you know, doing the miracles. That he is the Messiah, he's going to establish the kingdom, but this is not for them to worry about. I mean, the last thing he needs the public doing and his disciples doing is trying to help him make this happen. So don't even think about this. That's going to happen, but first, you need to understand he's this. This is what, as far as their generation, as far as them face-to-face with Jesus in his ministry, this is what they've got to get used to. This is what you're going to see. This is what you're going to experience. You're going to experience the suffering servant. And so, talking to the disciples. So chapter 8 of Mark, verse 30, Peter just says, "You are the Christ." Verse 30, Jesus warned them not to tell anyone about him because they will misunderstand it. He then began to teach them that the Son of Man, this eschatological figure, must suffer many things. The Messiah, who's going to establish the kingdom, is the Son of Man, the eschatological figure that will judge all mankind. But that eschatological figure, the Son of Man, must suffer many things. Must suffer many things and be rejected by the elders, the chief priests, and the teachers of the law. In other words, the very people that should understand precisely what has been taught, that God has prophesied all these things, laid it out for them, those very people, the elders, the chief priests, the teachers of the law, they're going to reject him. They are not going to receive this message very well. In fact, they're going to reject him, and he must be killed. Now, again, that's going to be handed over to the Romans, and he'll be crucified, as we know. So you're going to have a breakdown of the greatest religious system, the clearest prophecy, the keepers of the Word of God that predict Jesus. They're holding those in their hand. When they see it, they reject it. And they hand them over to what we consider one of the greatest judicial systems, Rome, and they're going to find him guilty, although they don't find him guilty. He goes through a series of trials, and he's innocent every time. So the religious system that is the keepers of the prophecy fail. Those that are to protect him, the innocent man, fail because the suffering servant has to suffer. That's the plan of God. And so all of mankind is going to collapse and fail as he goes through his death because you can blame, they're all going to be responsible and held accountable, but you can help that he's going to go to his death and you're going to collapse and fail. And he must be killed and after 3 days rise again. Verse 32, he spoke plainly about this. Now see, this is different. He spoke in parables, going up the opening of the book of Mark, parables, stories, things that they had to ask for meaning and interpret. Do you understand these things? And he'd explain it to them. Now, he's the Messiah. The Messiah is going to have to suffer. Let me say it plainly. And again, he explained it right there. And in verse 32, he spoke plainly about this. He was not telling them a parable. He was not using figures of speech. He was saying plain. He identifies the people who's going to reject him. He talked about what's going to be the result and his resurrection. He taught them, spoke plainly about this, and Peter took him aside and began to rebuke him. This does not make sense. You can understand. It's like we're in the same category, Peter. I mean, imagine. And again, I can't even think, I've thought about it a little bit, but I can't even think of something. I have my eschatological charts, my eschatology, what I've got figured out, and we can talk about what's going to take place. And there's some continuity in the general Protestant evangelical idea. I mean, if they're in the Bible, if they're not in the Bible, who knows what they think. You know, we got some issues, you know, is it a pre-trib, mid-trib rapture? Is it, you know, premillennial or postmillennial. We've got some ideas that we're all got these models, but we're all trying to figure this out. But their understanding, they have, if you were to tell me, you know, oh, pre-trib, mid-trib, you know, post-trib, and I've got my opinion, but I understand the different sides. And it's like, and I, you know, you put all the verses together and you align, it's like, I don't see it that way, but I can see how that would work. If you change this, and I've misinterpreted this, then this would be right or this would be right. So, I mean, I understand these. I can fathom certain things that I disagree with being true because I may be wrong in my interpretation. That's not what's happening here. It's not like, you know, we're not sure what comes first. If the crown comes before the cross or the cross comes before the crown. It's like, and Jesus, okay, well, let me explain it to you. The cross is going to come first. Okay, well, I always thought the crown would come first, but okay, I that makes sense. Like, you know, say the rapture or something. He starts talking about the cross or the crucifixion, and Peter's like, that's not on anybody's chart. I mean, no one's even talking about that. It'd be like throwing something into my eschatological chart. You know, I'm trying to think of something that would even make sense. That it's like, that's ridiculous, but it is going to happen. And then I wonder, without having any idea of what I'm not referring to, if I knew what I was referring to, I could tell you. But I wonder if as things go on through, and we know it's happened in our own personal lives, things that we thought was going to happen didn't occur, and we saw God's hand going a different direction, which ends up being God. If it are, you know, the continuity of eschatology, if something's going to happen, that's going to be like, we never saw that coming. And there's going to be a lot of people reject it because it doesn't make sense. And it's going to take Jesus opening our eyes to accept it. And then we're going to say, well, it's in the Bible, but no theologians talked about it. No pastors presented it. No one's wrote a book about it. And all of a sudden, there it is. And once it's there, man, I wish I would have wrote the book because I would have been the only one that wrote the book. And that's kind of what's happening right here. Because Peter doesn't say, I've got to change my theology a little bit. It's like he rebukes Jesus. He flat out says, that's not going to happen. There's no place for you to suffer. But when Jesus turned and looked at his disciples, he rebuked Peter. So he apparently turns and it not necessarily speaks to the whole group, although the whole group is going to hear him, but he rebukes Peter in front of the group, one, so they can hear that Peter's idea is being rebuked, possibly because of their part of the idea. Again, you have to decide how you're going to read that. He rebuked Peter, and he says, "Get behind me, Satan. You do not have in mind the things of God, but the things of men." And again, Satan right there, especially in the book of Mark, that clearly means Satan. Again, you can translate that. You know, Satan would mean the accuser. You're accusing me, or you're coming against me, you're the opposition. That could be interpreted that way, except for the fact that throughout the book of Mark, Satan has been a person that has been not a people, but a personality, a spirit, an individual that has appeared to Jesus, that has tempted Jesus, that has spoken through demons. So this is clearly, he's talking about Satan. Get behind me, Satan, and makes it very clear. You have in mind the things of God, but you do not have in mind the things of God, but the things of man. Then an interesting verse 34, we'll pick this up next week. Then he called the crowd to him along with his disciples and said, and now here's the teaching to help them wrap their mind around this. They're not supposed to talk about him being the Messiah. Don't talk about that. But now notice right here, now when we get back in public, he starts talking about the suffering part. Don't talk about the Messiah. They don't understand that. But what they do need to see and understand, and this is the book of Mark, is because if you're going to be a disciple, here's the thing. This is the book of Mark. Not only is Jesus going to suffer, you're going to suffer. Not only did Jesus suffer as he followed God and fulfilled God's will, if you're going to follow Jesus, you're walking the same road. And that's, again, Rome 64 AD. That's who he's writing to. It's like, and so why are all these things happening? Well, read the book. Are you following Christ? Yes, but why are we being thrown to the animals? Because you're following Christ. But what about the crown? What about the victory? Well, did Jesus get the victory? Not until he went through the cross. And so he began teaching the crowds this: if anyone would come after me, okay, if anyone's going to follow me, he must deny himself and take up his cross and follow me. For whoever wants to save his life will lose it. But whoever loses his life for me and for the gospel will save it. What good is it for a man to gain the whole world yet forfeit his soul? I mean, right there, that is saying you can't have the crown before the cross. I can't establish the kingdom of God, Jesus would say, until I've given myself as a ransom for many. Because I can establish the kingdom, but what good would it do? You can't be part of it. Well, we're following you. You can't follow me completely until I've redeemed you and I've paid for you. I've got to bring you into me, into my presence, so I can bring you into the kingdom. So we've got to have Jesus go to the cross so he can save us, redeem us, so that when he establishes the kingdom, we can be there. Otherwise, he could establish the kingdom and he'd be all alone. There'd be no people with him. No, it's like, well, yeah, but these are good people. All the people of the Old Testament died in faith waiting for the redemption. They died in faith, but they didn't die redeemed. They were waiting for Christ. If Christ doesn't finish the work, they died in vain because it never happened. And so whoever loves his life for me, or whoever loses his life for me and for the gospel will save it. What good is it for a man to gain the whole world yet forfeit his soul? Or what can a man give in exchange for his soul? If anyone is ashamed of me and my words in this adulterous and sinful generation, that would speak to us. You're ashamed of Jesus in this generation. You want to side with this generation and these ideologies and don't want to be committed to Christ. Well, the Son of Man, Son of Man, that's the eschatological judge of all mankind, will be ashamed of him when it comes to judgment and he establishes his reality as culture. Then he will be ashamed of you because you sided with this adulterous culture. Really, there's no room for that compromise. It's like you've got to take a stand. We'll be ashamed of him when he comes in his Father's glory with the holy angels. So there's the Son of Man, the eschatological judge, coming in the Father's glory. That's the Messiah. He will be the Messiah, but he's got to first go to the cross. Now, on your notes, I've got a couple boxes here on the notes, and the top box is right off of last week's notes, but it's worth looking at again. There's three times in Mark that Jesus is going to announce his death. And this is radical. Again, I want to say that several times because we just get used to the Christmas story, the Easter story. Easter's coming up, and yes, Jesus dies, Jesus resurrected, and we go along the way. But at this time, before the Gospels took place, or before the Gospels were written, before the Gospel occurred, it was radical. And so when Jesus tells them three times, chapter 8, verse 31, chapter 9, verse 30, chapter 10, verse 33, that he's going to go to Jerusalem, that he's going to be betrayed, he's going to be handed over, he'll be crucified, they all three times say, no, no, no. The first time, we just saw it, Peter rebukes Jesus. The next time in chapter 9, verse 30, the disciples do not understand, and they do not ask. They learn from the last time. Peter did not understand, so he stepped up and said something and rebuked the Lord. That's the first time. The second time Jesus says it, no one understands it, but it's like, I ain't going to say anything. He went off and called him saint. It's like, they don't understand, but they don't ask. It's like, and the third time, chapter 10, verse 33 through 34, James and John now take a shot at it. Maybe they think they figured it out. When he says he's going to go and be crucified, they come up and say, can we sit on your right and on your left in your kingdom? Okay, whatever you mean about dying, but I know you're going to go sit on your throne. Can we sit on your right and on your left? It's like, guys, I mean, they clearly do not understand. Again, we'll be critical of them, but as I reflect, I'm critical of myself without even knowing what I'm being critical of. Because I am the disciples. I am Peter. I am James. I am John. I'm rebuking Jesus. I'm not understanding, but I'm afraid to ask. And I am asking for things that it's like, you understand how out of line you are for asking for that. No, I do not know how ignorant I am. I mean, you understand what I'm saying? It's like, I can't say, these are the three things I'm struggling with, because neither could Peter, James, or John. It's like, Jesus, you're not right. That doesn't make any sense. And he got chewed out. We don't understand, but I'm not going to say it. I don't even understand what I'm confused about. Finally, James and John think they got figured out. We're going to ask him to sit on his right and on his left. It's like, ooh, that didn't go over well either. It's like, so somewhere I'm mixed up. But what Jesus does, Peter rebukes, the disciples don't understand and don't ask. James and John ask to sit on the right and left. And every time what Jesus does, he follows it up with teaching. That's Jesus touching their eyes to open their eyes. In Peter's case in chapter 8 that we're looking at right now, Jesus teaches the deny yourself. We just read those verses. Peter says, not so, it's not going to happen. He gets rebuked. He teaches. Chapter 9, 33 through 50, that's where he teaches the first must be last. You're going to have to be a servant. Well, that's the next one. Chapter 10, verse 38, the third time, greatness is to become a servant. Jesus came to give his life as a ransom for many. So, if we reflect on our lives, if we want to make any reflection on our life right now, I'm following Jesus, I'm living the good life, I'm being obedient, okay, Jesus is going to the cross, he's going to suffer and die. What are you doing? Well, I'm following Jesus. Well, then you're going to suffer and die. What's it going to look like? Well, it's greatness is going to be that you're a servant. It's like you're going to be serving. And no one's even going to say thank you. It's not like a servant is like they don't let us leave tips or something. You know, in America, we maybe leave tips or we say thank you or whatever. I mean, in America. I mean, you go to foreign countries. We went to New Zealand, Taiwan, other countries like Israel. I mean, people are so gracious. It's almost embarrassing to be an American in another country because people are so gracious. But nonetheless, to be a servant, you would expect nothing like no thanks. And Jesus came to give his life as a ransom. If we're following Jesus, our life is to be given away. Again, not just destroyed meaninglessly, but following Christ, you're going to just be giving away your life. So that's again, the point of Mark. The other points right here on this. Point one, we talk about the first and second half. Point two, the two-step healing. Point three, like the conversation in the boat about the leavened bread. And that goes into this next point. This next box is exactly what I wrote up here at the beginning, I believe. The three stages of healing. You got the blind man, you got the disciples. The three stages, they had no sight, no understanding. Chapter 8, verse 22, it was a blind man. And with the disciples, they're on the boat coming across. He's basically calling them blind. He says, do you not yet perceive or understand? Are your hearts so hardened? Having eyes, do you not see? Having ears, do you not hear? They're just like the blind man's blind. Their hearts cannot perceive the truth. Then they have partial understanding. The man, Jesus, spits and touches his eyes. Do you see anything? He says, I see people, but they look like trees walking. And that's what takes place in chapter 8, verse 29. But who do you say I am? You are the Christ. Okay, you see Christ. You see the Messiah, but you see him marching on Jerusalem and destroying the Romans. Let's bring that into perspective. He's going to Jerusalem, but not like a tree. He's going to Jerusalem like a suffering servant. And now that begins to come into focus. And then completely seeing, when after Jesus touched the man's eyes, he opened his eyes, his sight was restored, he saw everything clearly. And then I don't have in the book of Mark a clear verse that says, and at that point the disciples understood clearly. You can see in the other Gospels, on the road to Emmaus, their hearts were burning while Jesus was talking to them. And then after he departed, they understood the Scriptures. The Scriptures were open to them. In John, Jesus says, I have things to tell you that you cannot now yet bear, but when the Spirit comes, you will understand them. I'm thinking in Luke, other times the Spirit came on them and their minds were open. So we have verses. The best we've got in Mark is the centurion at the cross saying, truly this man was the Son of God. I've got something else following up here. Very next thing, point five. In the book of Mark, again, this is a little bit of review. In the book of Mark, witnesses to Jesus being the Son of God or the Messiah begin with Mark. These are your witnesses here so far. In Mark, Mark himself says in chapter 1, the beginning of the gospel of Jesus Christ, the Son of God. And notice what it says, Jesus Christ or Jesus the Messiah, the Son of God. So Mark says it. Then God the Father at the baptism is going to say it in chapter 1, verse 11. And a voice came from heaven, that's at the baptism, you are my beloved Son, the Son of God, with you I am well pleased. So God is going to say it. Then you're going to have three occurrences. Now this is all before humans say it. Mark, the narrator, says it. God announces it. The demons, and there's three verses there written out, where the demons, when we've already seen this, chapter 1, verse 24, the demons say, what have you to do with us, Jesus of Nazareth? That's his name as a man. Jesus, the man from Nazareth. Have you come to destroy us? Well, how can a man from Nazareth destroy them? Because I know who you are, the Holy One of God. So the demons recognize him. Chapter 3, verse 11. Whenever the unclean spirits saw him, they fell down before him and cried out, you are the Son of God. And chapter 5, verse 7, crying out with a loud voice, he says, what have you to do with me, Jesus, Son of the Most High God? I adjure you, by God, do not torment me. So demons recognize him. And then finally, Peter, the first human, is going to now say at the peak of the book of Mark, at the turning point, that he is the Messiah, but yet that is void of full understanding. Let's go back and read. That's it right there. Okay, now on page 2, we'll take a moment here and look at the verse, the English Standard Version. Now, we just got done crossing the Sea of Galilee, healing the blind man in Bethsaida, and now it says, and Jesus went on with his disciples to the villages of Caesarea Philippi. And on the way, he asked his disciples, who do people say that I am? Now, Caesarea Philippi, let me see if I can play with my phone here and do this. Who knows what's going to happen? Here we go. I got to do this. There we go. There's our little map right there. See there, Magdala. We talk about two synagogues have just been found in Magdala, right there. They've been found, two synagogues have been excavated. They're here somewhere in this area. They land after coming from feeding the 4,000, have the conflict with the Pharisees. They go across to Bethsaida. That's where they have the conversation about the bread, the yeast of the Pharisees. They land at Bethsaida, take the man outside the village of Bethsaida, do the two-step healing. And then from here, they go straight north. It says to the villages of around Caesarea Philippi. Matthew says in the vicinity or in the area around there. So we'll talk about that. That's Caesarea Philippi. That is a city at the base of Mount Hermon. Mount Hermon is where the transfiguration is going to take place. Some people have it taking place somewhere down in Israel. It fits right here. It's Mount Hermon, which is also going to the Canaanites and the Ugaritic texts. These mountains have I haven't figured it out completely, but there's some writing being done with, you know, the gods and the mountains and the high places. But nonetheless, Mount Hermon is there. Caesarea Philippi, we're going to look at that here in a moment, is there. And then they're in this vicinity around there. Let's go ahead and do this, if you don't mind. It's 25 miles. 25 miles for a straight shot from Bethsaida to Caesarea Philippi, one day. It takes one day to walk. I know a guy that we've been in contact with each other. We email, message each other. But him and his son have walked Israel. When he goes to Israel, he doesn't take a bus tour. They hike. There's trails. So I think they're called the Jesus Trails or something. I don't know for sure. But he's walked this whole area, which is quite a thrill. I mean, you're just walking Israel. But anyway, that would be a one day walk if you made that walk there. This right here, water comes out of Mount Hermon. There's three fountains coming out. Or this time there's three. There's still water coming out. We're going to look at it. There's been a couple earthquakes take place, so things have shifted around. Certain things have been blocked shut, and the water comes up somewhere else. But the base of Mount Hermon, and that water is going to form streams that lead into the Sea of Galilee, which then flows out. It's the Jordan River flowing down into here. But here is some of the waters right here. There are better pictures of, like, the waterfalls. That's the one I've got right here. This right here is at the base. I just grabbed these real quick. I didn't get a good chance to look at them. That's a little fuzzy. But they're standing at the base of Mount Hermon. Mount Hermon rises up this way. This is a rock. There's the remains of many temples here. There's niches cut in the cave here, or the wall. That's one of the caves where water used to come out. This is just the water just rushing out with a temple over it, so the water would be coming out under there. They'd offer sacrifices, drop them down into the water. That was known as the gates of hell or gates of Hades. That's where the powers of the underworld would come out of. So if you wanted to worship the powers, the gods that had gone down in the ancient days and were in, you know, the underworld, you had close access to them. They could give you power, and if you could somehow access them through that, that's the gates of Hades right there. There we're looking straight at that rock. These are the niches right here. You have sometimes there's Greek writing in them. It's to Pan. Caesarea Philippi used to be called Panaeus or Panaeus. Now it's Banaeus because of the Aramaic, because the P and the B. Herod Antipas ruled down in northwest Galilee and Perea down by on the other side of the Jordan opposite Judea. This area was ruled by Herod Philip, not the Philip that was still in Rome who's lost his wife to Herod Antipas. This is another Philip, Herod, that is ruling up here. And so Jesus is outside of Herod Antipas' territory. And this is all Gentiles. Jews are not going to live here. You see this is a better picture, but you see those shrines right there. There's Greek text written here. And some of these are to Pan. The big one's to Pan, which the half man, half goat god. But then these are to the nymphs that would be servicing in the temple there. And that's a huge rock formation there, and water used to come out of there. And there's many other pictures I could show you. There, look at me. I was just discovering this location. First human to translate the Greek. But anyway, first got to take a goofy picture. But here, right up here, you see right here? That's Greek written right there, little plaque. And there would a statue, an idol would have stood right here, and he would have had, you know, there's also a temple, a shrine to Caesar well, they worshiped Caesar as God. Caesar was worshiped as a god. Their understanding of God was different. We think of God as the eternal outside of time. Their God could just be someone that had the power. A man could be. And that's, again, I didn't even look at these pictures. That's, again, another picture. You see the earthquake. Things have shifted around and moved. And that's a bad picture. I've got much better pictures of that. Oh, that's the ring I cleaned yesterday. Did you watch that video? Okay. Oh, boy, how do I do this now? Go back to here, get this on here. Under pressure. And airplay. And there it is. Boom. Look at that. Under pressure. Okay. That's Caesarea Philippi. And here's some things about that. On page 2 at the bottom, there you go. And Jesus went on with his disciples, or set out with his disciples. That means, the word is, implies a deliberate beginning of a destination, meaning he is setting out. They're not just wandering off. Well, that's fine. They went from the Pharisees, sailed across the Sea of Galilee, went to Bethsaida, and at that point they set out. He's on his way to Caesarea. He is going to Caesarea Philippi. That he's not like ended up there. He's going there. Here's some information right there. I wrote most of it. Philip rebuilt Peneus and named it after Augustus Caesar and himself, thus Caesarea Philippi. Caesarea for Caesar Augustus, and then Philippi for himself. Caesar and Philippi, the two of us. The fact is Caesar Augustus was dead before. But anyway, a famous pagan shrine. There was a grotto. We looked at some pictures there. There's much more I could say about that. I've got some of it in an Israel field book and on my website. The base of Mount Hermon next to the cave were the three major sources of water that emerged that began the Jordan River. A non-Jewish population. Oh, 200 B.C. It was at this location here at Caesarea Philippi where Antiochus or Antiochus IV or Antiochus Antiochus Epiphanes defeated the Egyptians. The Seleucids defeated the Ptolemies. At this point, and Egypt had to give up their control of Israel, beginning the Hellenization of Judea and Israel, which leads to the Maccabean Revolt, because Antiochus Epiphanes is the one who's going to instigate all that Hellenization. And again, that's a terrible situation there. But that's where it all began. Point four, if you're still with me on this. I didn't get it on the map, but one of the villages in that area is a village called Gamala. Now, Gamala was the home of a person named Judas, not Judas of our Bible. There's Judas Maccabeus, the great leader of the Maccabean Revolt. There's Judas Iscariot, Jesus' disciple. And this is Judas of G-A-M-A-L-A. Did I spell that right? Yeah, or Judas of Gamala, or Judas the Galilean. Now, this is important. This is important because Jesus is in this vicinity. The Bible doesn't make a connection to this. It just puts you in the area of Caesarea Philippi, which is where that grotto, where the temple to Caesar's at, where the gates of Hades are at, where the shrine to Pan was at, but also Gamala is where Judas the Galilean came from, and this is some information about him. His sons, he had two sons, Simon and Jacob, are his two sons. They are both going to be part of the starting of the Jewish revolt in 66 A.D., in this area at Gamala. There's going to be several things, but Judas the Galilean is going to start, according to Josephus, is going to start the fourth, in a sense, sect, or the fourth group. I've got it written down here in better terms. The fourth philosophy is what Judas or Josephus calls it. You're going to have the Pharisees, you're going to have the Sadducees, you're going to have the Essenes, but you're then also going to have a group called the Zealots, of which one of Jesus' disciples was a zealot. And the Zealots are going to branch off, or a certain group called the Sicarii, which means the dagger man, are going to join with the zealots. They're going to become the terrorists. They're going to become the militants. They're going to become the group that is in the culture trying to start a January 6th riot type of setting, if you want to play that game. But they're the ones that are going to start some kind of a revolt against Rome. The Sicarii were assassins. And they would, the Pharisees, Sadducees, Essenes, and the Zealots. And the Zealots are even mentioned in the scriptures. But Judas of the Galilean, I'll just read this. One of the villages was Gamala, the home of Judas the Galilean. His sons Simon and Jacob helped begin the war with Rome in 66 AD. They were later crucified by Rome. After the war, they were captured. They were crucified. According to Josephus, Judas was the founder of the fourth philosophy of the Jews called the Sicarii, or the dagger men, assassins who joined the zealots to liberate Jerusalem from Rome. Now, do you understand this? Jesus is, the Bible doesn't say this is true. This is history. Jesus is in the villages and the area around Caesarea Philippi, which is this city, Gamala, and he's going to be at the base of Mount Hermon, the gates of Hades. So as he's passing by, they're going past the home of a group of people, or the Judas Galilean, that is actually what the disciples are expecting. It was what the people, when Jesus fed the 5,000, they came to take him by force and make him king by force, because this is Judas the Galilean. Jesus is in the land, leaving the land of Galilee. I mean, this was going on before Jesus got there. Simon and Jacob, his sons, are going to help start the revolt. And watch this. The other three groups have gotten rid of. Judas's nephew. This guy's, his nephew, Manahem, and Manahem's nephew, Eleazar Ben-Jair, were both on Masada in 73 A.D., at the Jews' last stand. So his nephew and the nephew of his nephew were with that group at Masada that just held out, and they had to build the Romans had to build a ramp up to the top of Masada, and when they finally got there and broke through the wall, the last Jews, according to Josephus and some archaeology kind of supports it, They took turns committing suicide. They killed each other by drawing names. And his nephew and his nephew's nephew would be those, some of the men that were there who had to draw names out of the hat of who's going to kill who. And finally, the last man standing had to kill himself. So when the Romans broke in, the Jews had killed themselves. And that was the last. That is where this ideal of a Messiah is going to end. I mean, this can't be any more real. Jesus kept saying throughout the book of Mark, don't tell anybody. Because this, if you get what you want, you're going to lose your life. You're going to lose it all. Judas the Galilean thought it'd be a great idea. He started the Sicarii, helped with the Zealots to help bring up a revolt. His two sons helped start the revolt in 66 AD. They ended up getting crucified just like Jesus. They had the crown before the cross. And then his nephews ended up the last stand on Masada in 73 AD, and the whole nation was gone. The whole nation suffered, and none of them, if we were just assume the general surface of the story, none of them saved their soul. They all lost their soul. They tried to gain the world and lost their soul, and Jesus is trying desperately to avoid this. We're not going to go here first. We've got to go to the suffering servant. Now, does that make sense? I mean, I think there's a lot of insight into what's taking place, and I'm rushing through it and not doing a real clean job. On the way, Jesus asked them, what do men say that I am? Chapter 8, verse 28. And they told him, John the Baptist, the others, Elijah, some others, and one of the prophets. So again, we could talk about what that means. John the Baptist was a big one because, again, it doesn't even make sense because John the Baptist and Jesus were cousins. They were alive at the same time. John the Baptist baptized Jesus. John the Baptist gets his head cut off and becomes Jesus. I mean, it doesn't make sense, but there was that talk. Even Herod Antipas said that. And he asked them, but who do you say that I am? And Peter answered, you are the Christ. And here it is, point one, Christ is from Christos in the Greek. I've got it written down there. Many were anointed. I put two D's by B because I'm going to come back and add something. Point two, after the house of David fell, now here's a little bit of history on this, and I see if I can do this quick. I've said this already. People began to look for the restoration of the line of David, not fully connecting it to the Son of Man, who will be the eschatological judge, or the suffering servant of Isaiah. Israel still thinks and did that the suffering servant of Isaiah 53 was Israel themselves. The suffering, in that whole story, the suffering servant is Israel. You can talk to Jews today, I have in Jerusalem, and they say the suffering servant is Israel because they are the ones that are suffering for the plan of God. And it's kind of like, well, no, I think that's an individual. I think that's Jesus. And you could spend time explaining it, but someone's already explained it to them, and they don't see that. So they don't make that connection. But they did connect this, the Messiah, to Jeremiah 23:5. Behold, the days are coming, declares the Lord, when I will raise up for David a righteous branch, and he shall reign as king and deal wisely and shall execute justice and righteousness in the land. Now, I've got to get to this right. I want to point this out right here. This is, just so you understand, this is where they were at. This is the Psalms of Solomon, chapter 17, verses 23 through 33. It is an apocryphal book. It's not scripture. We're not looking at it as scripture. We're looking at it. It was written between 150 to 20 AD. It was written during this time that the ideal of the Messiah was coming, the Messiah, where they take all the Old Testament, they bring this together, and this deliverer is coming. So this would be a verse. Now, it is in the Septuagint, and they have the apocryphal books in the Septuagint, and it does end up in the Syrian text of Scripture in their Bible, and I've got that written down here. A quote from the apocryphal book of Psalms of Solomon, chapter 17. This is part of a chapter from the Psalms of Solomon, which is a group of 18 psalms written between 150 and 20 BC that are not part of the current scriptural canon, but they are found in copies of the Peshitta, which is the Syrian church scripture, and the Septuagint, which is the Greek translation of the Hebrew scriptures around 200 BC. So this was familiar to them. I'll read it very quickly. This is what it says. Behold, O Lord, and raise up unto them their king, the son of David, at the time in which thou seest, O God, that he may reign over Israel, thy servant, and gird him with strength, that he may shatter unrighteous rulers, that he may purge Jerusalem from nations that trample her down to destruction. Wisely, righteously, he shall thrust out sinners from the inheritance out of Israel, and he shall destroy the pride of the sinner as a potter's vessel. With a rod of iron he shall break in pieces all their substance. He shall destroy the godless nations with the word of his mouth. At his rebuke, nations shall flee before him, and he shall reprove sinners for the thoughts of their heart. And he shall judge the tribes of the people that has been sanctified by the Lord his God. And he shall not suffer unrighteous to lodge any more in their midst, nor shall there dwell with them any man that knoweth wickedness. For he shall know them, and that they are all sons of their God. And he shall divide them according to their tribes upon the land, and neither sojourner nor alien shall sojourn with them any more. He shall judge peoples and nations in the wisdom and righteousness, Shelah, think about it. And he shall have the heathen nations to serve him under his yoke, and he shall glorify the Lord in a place to be seen of all the earth. And he shall purge Jerusalem, making it holy as of old. Now, that is the concept of the Messiah they're looking for. When Peter says, you are the Christ, that's correct. But don't tell anybody. And then he began to explain plainly, guys, this is not going to happen. The Son of Man is going to suffer many things. He's going to be betrayed and handed over to the Romans. He'll be crucified, and on the third day he'll rise. This is not going to happen. And they're like, what? They couldn't understand it. And he's saying this right outside the house, right outside the village, right in the vicinity of where the organizer of the Sicarii, who had sons that started the Roman Revolution, and nephews who died on Masada, he's standing right there saying, that's not me. I'm going to suffer. I'm going to give my life for a ransom for many. Now, will Jesus come back and establish the kingdom? Yes, but the cross before the crown. And that's kind of what we're looking at right here. It's a huge verse. And it, again, like I said, this is where it turns. And the rest of the book, there'll be miracles. There'll be things that indicate Jesus is more than just a man. But the rest of this book is about Jesus going to the cross. He's introducing a brand. Again, it's not new to us, but it is radical for the Jews and for the disciples. He's introducing a brand new side of Messiah. He's introducing the suffering servant. It's like, and it's not like, oh yeah, we used to learn this in Sunday school. They've never learned it in synagogue. They've never heard it. They're reading this kind of stuff. Okay, I'll pray and we're done. Father, we do thank you for the chance to look into these things. We do ask that we would honor them, that we would learn from them, that we would also understand our own weakness and understanding the things that we think we understand. We know your Spirit abides within us. We know that Jesus Christ is Lord and your word is pure. We just ask that it would penetrate our hearts and let our ears and eyes see it. In Jesus' name we pray. Amen. Thank you for your time.